It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 27 degrees under mostly cloudy skies now. Out at the airport, they have variable winds up to 6 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day and tonight too. A 50% chance of snow showers today and a high likelihood of snow showers tonight. They are calling for maybe an inch of snow to fall tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, it's back to the revisions table for an agreement between the Kodiak Island Sportsmen's Association and the borough to operate the island's main outdoor firing range. The Kodiak History Museum has a new art exhibit, and it's featuring the Kodiak High School's advanced art class. Plus, the statewide spending plan is headed to a vote in the Alaska House of Representatives this week. And Russia objecting to claims made by the United States in the Arctic.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Abortions will soon be outlawed in Arizona, except in cases where a pregnant patient's life is at risk. Ben Giles from member station KJZZ reports the state Supreme Court has ruled that Arizona should follow a restrictive abortion law dating back to the 1860s.
Since December 2022, Arizona doctors have been allowed to provide abortions up to 15 weeks into a pregnancy, based on a lower court's interpretation of state laws. But in a divided 4-2 ruling, the state Supreme Court now says Arizona should follow an older law that bans abortions in almost all cases. It makes no exceptions for rape or incest and makes performing an abortion punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. Abortion advocates are decrying the decision, and an effort is already underway to put a measure on 2024 ballots that would enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution. For NPR News, I'm Ben Giles in Phoenix.
The decision out of Arizona is drawing ire from the White House. In a statement, President Biden says the ruling will subject millions of women of childbearing age in the state to a more extreme and dangerous abortion ban. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Israel has been allowing more aid trucks into Gaza, but he says humanitarian efforts need to be sustained. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the U.S. continues to discuss ways to avoid a ground operation in Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinian civilians are sheltering.
Secretary Blinken says the Israelis have not given the U.S. a date for a Rafah operation, and the U.S. is still trying to talk the Israelis out of it, offering other ideas to deal with the Hamas battalions in that part of Gaza. He says there will be more talks with the Israelis next week. On aid, he says more is getting in.
The commitments that have been made and the initial steps to implement those commitments are positive, but a lot more needs to happen to make sure that people in Gaza have what they need.
Secretary Blinken says the U.S. is also working 24/7 on a hostage deal, and he's calling on Hamas to agree to the latest offer. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Norfolk Southern has agreed to settle a class action lawsuit in the aftermath of last year's train derailment in eastern Ohio. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the accident resulted in the spill of hazardous chemicals in the region.
Norfolk Southern's agreed to pay $600 million to settle claims from people living within 20 miles of where the train left the track in East Palestine, Ohio. The railroad has already paid more than $1 billion towards the cleanup and promised to set up a fund for residents' long-term health care needs.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley reporting. This is NPR News in Washington.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. The Kodiak Island Sportsmen's Association wants to establish a new lease with the borough to operate the island's main outdoor firing range. But last week, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly postponed voting on a 5-year lease for the Saloni Creek Rifle Range, continuing the years-long gap without a formal agreement. The proposed lease also includes a separate site where a caretaker for the range can live. A former lease between the borough and the Sportsmen's Association for the land where Saloni Creek Rifle Range is located expired in August of 2019. Now, borough staff and the Sportsmen's Association have drawn up a new 5-year lease that also includes a section called the Lead Management Plan. But Assembly Member Ryan Sherritt says there's a problem. The current wording in the plan could potentially bankrupt the nonprofit by implying that Kodiak Island Sportsmen's Association would be financially responsible for removing all lead contamination at the range going back to World War II.
And the lease says that it shall submit that plan to the KIB for approval. The KIB is not an authoritative figure to approve a lead management plan. That's through the EPA. So I think that this lease needs to actually go back into a work session and have some of those details ironed out.
The line in question states, quote, "Lessee shall remove all lead from the property that exceeds permissible levels at its own expense, utilizing a qualified person or business," end quote. Borough manager Amy Williams told the Assembly that was not the intent of the lead management section in the lease, and the borough does not want to put undue responsibility on the Sportsmen's Association.
Although we did have the attorney look at this, I do agree that that last sentence should come out of there because it does imply their responsibility would be way more than what their responsibility should be.
Ultimately, the borough assembly voted the proposed lease down 5-2 so that borough staff and the Sportsmen's Association could revise certain aspects of the lease, including the lead management plan. The new lease will be discussed during an upcoming Kodiak Island Borough Assembly work session, and the next one is scheduled for Thursday, April 11th.
KMXT is supported in part by the Kodiak Daily Mirror, your hometown newspaper since 1940. Online at www.kodiakdailymirror.com.
The Kodiak History Museum has a new exhibit featuring artwork from the Kodiak High School's advanced art class. Lynn Walker, the museum's curator, says it's an experiment to showcase local artists.
We're trying to open up our gallery space in between our big temporary exhibits to, you know, feature local artists and serve that community need. You know, a lot of grants for artists you have to have shown publicly before. And so we are trying to, you know, facilitate that.
The 1-month-long exhibit features a glass case filled with pottery as well as paintings and mixed media on the walls. The museum partnered with the high school to focus on, quote, up-and-coming artists. Walker says she hopes to feature more Kodiak artists between their temporary exhibits, which are on display for about 6 months each.
So we're trying things out, so we don't have, like, the system established yet.
The high school art will be on display at the museum until April 27th. Silver Bay Seafoods is poised to take over Peter Pan Seafood's processing operations this year, according to a joint press release on Thursday. Silver Bay will acquire Peter Pan's Valdez facility, as well as operate Peter Pan's facilities in Dillingham and Port Moeller during the 2024 salmon season. As reported by KUCB, the move is part of a larger restructuring for Silver Bay to take over all of Peter Pan's processing and support facilities later this year, including the Peter Pan plant in King Cove. Two of the largest salmon processors in the state, Peter Pan and Silver Bay, each have facilities next to each other in Valdez. They previously discussed partnering with one another, including talks of forming a joint venture. Ultimately, however, Peter Pan decided to sell the cannery and its assets to Seattle-based Silver Bay. Silver Bay CEO Cora Campbell said in a press release, "The Alaska seafood industry needs to improve efficiency in order to, quote, remain competitive in a global marketplace and continue to support viable coastal communities," end quote. Roiling global markets and floods of foreign fish have thrown Alaska's seafood industry into turmoil. P. Peter Pan's troubles have been particularly bad. The company's plant in King Cove remained closed this winter, and some fishermen have filed liens against the company for money owed from last season's catch. New U.S. claims to seabed territory off Alaska have run into an objection from the Russian government. The Russian government has staked territorial claims to most of the Arctic Ocean and is challenging the U.S. claims made in December. The U.S. claims take sovereignty over 520,400 square kilometers of extended outer continental shelf in the Arctic Ocean, an area bigger than California, and another 176,330 square kilometers in the Bering Sea. The Alaska Beacon reports that Russia's delegation argued at a meeting of the International Seabed Commission in Jamaica last month that the U.S. does not have the right to make such claims because it is not a party to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said the Russian objection is puzzling because the claims made in December by the U.S. State Department did not overlap any territory claimed by Russia. Whatever grounds Russia might cite, she said its objection is an example of how the U.S. is at a disadvantage because it has not ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty under which such claims are adjudicated. Alaska's first draft statewide spending plan is headed toward a vote in the Alaska House of Representatives. The Alaska Beacon reported on Friday that members of the House Finance Committee voted without dissent to send the $12.3 billion state operating budget to a vote of the full House. Throughout last week, the budget's size has fluctuated as lawmakers cut and added projects to a document that will pay for the state's services during the 12 months beginning July 1st. The budget's single biggest piece is the more than $1.7 billion for the 2024 permanent fund dividend, enough to pay each recipient over $2,700. That amount could fluctuate as the budget goes through amendments on the House and to the Senate and finally to the governor. The new version of the budget contains $175 million in a one-time funding for public schools as well. A young humpback whale was rescued in Unalaska last Friday after being entangled in suspected fishing gear for at least 4 days. As KUCB's Sophia Stewart Rossi reports, whale entanglement experts called it a success story thanks to community response.
The whale was first reported on April 1st. It was anchored down in a highly trafficked area near Dutch Harbor in Alulik Bay. 4 days later, a group of whale entanglement experts were able to carefully cut the line that was wrapped around the humpback's mouth and tail. Ed Lyman coordinates entanglement responses for the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary. He says the whale was likely a 2-year-old male who was hogtied. Lyman says it probably happened while he was feeding in the area.
Gets the line wrapped up in the mouth, panics, twirls up. Suddenly, it's got it on its tail as well, between mouth and tail.
It's unclear what type of fishing gear was weighing down the 30-foot whale, but it did give enough slack for the humpback to come up for air. Lyman has conducted well over 100 whale entanglements. He says even though the entanglements can be life-threatening, they are not immediate. He says because whales are large animals, and breaking them free can be deadly if not done carefully.
They have time on their side. We have time on our side. I've never been involved in an entanglement where the animals died in a day or two. These are big animals again.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Dutch Harbor got the call about the entangled whale from locals who noticed the large mammal was breathing and unable to move freely. Marine traffic in the area was notified of the situation. The U.S. Coast Guard in Alaska and the nonprofit organization Marine Exchange of Alaska were able to post a hazard on a digital map so vessels coming into the harbor could see and avoid the entangled humpback. Asia Beter is the state's assistant area management biologist for Dutch Harbor. She says the patience from the Unalaska community was a key part of the successful rescue.
I know this was a very emotional story and event for the community, and by giving us that report and keeping the distance and allowing us the time, I think that created this into a success story.
Staff with the local fish and game office were advised by experts on how to get footage of the whale entanglement using a pole with a camera attached. That helped the whale experts figure out what specialized tools were needed. Sadie Wright is a large whale entanglement response coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She's based in Juneau and has conducted more than a dozen whale entanglements. Wright says whales can get themselves out of some tangles, but based on the photos and reports collected from the Unalaska community, this whale needed help.
So it was a life-threatening entanglement, and we determined it needed an advanced response. So reporting's essential.
The actual rescue took 2 days. From a boat, the local fish and game biologists and visiting whale experts gathered data from video footage. They floated around the whale and sometimes even over it. Wright says the team used a large pole with a hook knife at the end of it. The pole also had a camera attached so they could see in real time where the knife was cutting the rope.
We knew which line we wanted to cut first and then second to try to encourage the wrap to then come off by itself to slide off the animal, which eventually happened.
Lyman, the expert from Hawaii, says the whale was fairly cooperative, not thrashing around.
It also seemed curious at times. There was times where the boat was coming up and it would almost like rise up a little bit more and lean over a little bit, like, what are you guys doing? Why are you here? You know, kind of thing.
After the whale was cut loose, the team followed him out of the bay and into the Bering Sea. They say the whale looked good and that it was swimming normally. Once it got further out, it picked up some speed and took a nice deep dive.
Really, really good chance this animal's going to be fine. I mean, I would almost bet on it, and I'm not a betting man.
The whale rescue team says in order to prevent whale entanglements, it's important to not put anything in the water that isn't needed. And fishermen should minimize using floating lines where feeding whales could get caught. The young humpback whale is currently identifiable with a string-like mark on its dorsal fin. The team thinks the mark is from when the whale was trying to break free from the gear. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart-Rossi.
Demolition of Fairbanks' tallest building is scheduled to get underway this spring. The community gathered on Friday outside the Polaris building to commemorate the iconic high-rise's past and to look to the future. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Polaris was once the focus of downtown activity, but has been closed and deteriorating for the past 20 years.
Local historian Joni Skillbred summarized the life of the Polaris for a crowd that gathered outside the 72-year-old concrete high-rise. Skillbred explained that when it opened in 1952, the Polaris was the crown jewel of a downtown Fairbanks urban renewal effort with 144 apartments and a range of commercial offerings.
Over the years, there were several restaurants, bars, public and private offices, meeting spaces, radio and TV transmitters, and many stores, all located within the building. It also served the Fairbanks community as the official Cold War fallout shelter. There was even a private detective office in there.
This was the town center.
City Mayor David Prust highlighted the building's role in Fairbanks' growth and identity over the decades.
So many families, so many businesses, so much activity started here. Everyone has a Polaris story, be it inside or just walking by it. Everyone has a Polaris story.
The living story of the Polaris ground to a halt in 2001 when, operating as a seasonal hotel, frozen pipes resulted in severe flood damage that closed the building for good, leading it to become an iconic eyesore. Mayor Prust leads a city group that spent years securing ownership of the decaying Polaris and looking for funding for its demolition. Prust credited many people for making it happen.
You know, sometimes it takes a village.
Mayor Prust shared the podium Friday with Alaska U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who secured $10 million from the Environmental Protection Agency for the Polaris demolition project. Senator Murkowski underscored that the building had a good life.
But as with everything, there's a time. And this building's time was 20 years ago. And so in the interim, it's been nothing but a blight.
Murkowski described its upcoming removal, which will open a prime downtown lot, as an opportunity to dream big.
To give that golden heart new life, this is what today is all about.
Murkowski symbolically launched the project by breaking a bottle of champagne on the side of the Polaris. Polaris demolition actually began last summer with the removal of a one-story addition known as the Annex, and pre-demo work on the main tower, including clearing its interior and removal of asbestos, is nearing completion.
And then once it's all cleaned and abated, they call it, and then the actual deconstruction of the building starts.
City engineer Bob Pristash explained that the structure's walls are coated with paint containing PCBs and will be carefully cut into pieces.
So they'll start taking it down and see how it goes, and in pieces, and lowering it down with the crane. And then when it gets far enough down, they can start using their high-reach excavator to start pulling pieces down.
Pristash says water will be used to minimize dust.
It's a mist. It isn't like a fire hose or anything. It's just enough to keep it moist, so it's not any runoff.
The plan has been to ship the concrete to a specialized hazardous waste landfill in Idaho, but Pristash says an alternate approach is being considered.
They might take the chunks of the concrete down and try to remove the PCB from the concrete off-site.
The Polaris demolition contract with Coldfoot Engineering requires the building to be down by the end of October. The city of Fairbanks plans to consider private proposals for redevelopment of the site. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska State Troopers closed a section of the Richardson Highway north of Delta Junction for 2 hours on Sunday after Manh Cho Mine ore haul trucks backed up on Tenderfoot Hill in slippery conditions. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Tractor-trailer operator Bruce Smith says he was headed south on the Richardson Highway Sunday afternoon approaching Tenderfoot Hill when he got word from another trucker about a big rig traffic jam ahead.
Another driver went through before I did, and he gave me a heads up, so I was prepared.
Smith says it was snowing and the accumulated slush on the highway was making for slick conditions as he approached the big hill about 25 miles north of Delta Junction. He says the falling snow made it hard to see until he got to the summit where two ore haul trucks were visible, stopped on the side of the northbound lanes, and a third parked down at the foot of the hill.
Oh, yeah, they weren't going anywhere. Not at 160,000 pounds. They're not moving.
That's about what one of the Manh Cho double trailer rigs weighs fully loaded. According to a spokesperson for Kinross, Alaska, the mine's majority owner, one ore truck spun out on the hill and five others coming from both directions stopped as a precaution. Meadow Rydell says they pulled over after the stuck truck's driver radioed to the others advising about the slippery conditions.
And so everyone was aware that as they were going up the hill on either side, they would need to stop.
Rydell says that's the safety protocol established by Kinross and its North Pole-based ore haul trucking contractor, Black Gold Transport.
So it took about 3 hours from when he stopped, radio dispatch, everyone was notified of what the conditions were like. Tow truck and the safety staff with Black Gold Transport were dispatched.
Rydell says the other two fully loaded northbound ore trucks and two empty southbound rigs all had to be towed up the hill. She says as far as she knows, the incident was the first for the ore haul trucking operation that began late last year.
I haven't heard of another one that is like this. This seems to be very unique and the weather seems to be very unique.
DOT spokesperson John Perrault says the heavy snow shower was like a microburst focused on Tenderfoot Hill.
The snow was a little bit unexpected this weekend, and it all came down in about a half an hour from what our plow driver told us.
Perrault says two DOT plow trucks were dispatched to spread gravel on the highway while the half dozen ore rigs backed up on both sides of the hill. Kinross's Rydell says the company's been increasing the number of trucks it's running from the Manh Cho mine near Tetlin to its Fort Knox mill north of Fairbanks to an average of 40 round trips a day.
We're also in the initial stages of this, you know, as we're working on putting more trucks on the road, and this is really the first kind of microstorm that we've had happen and had to respond in this way.
Rydell says the plan is to increase the average number of daily round-trip ore truck runs to 60 as soon as Black Gold can train more drivers and take delivery of additional side dumper trailers. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Small business owners are in a sour mood. I'm Nova Sapa with the Marketplace Minute. The latest survey from the National Federation of Independent Business finds hiring plans among its members are at their weakest since May 2020. Only 11% of firms said they plan to create new jobs in the next 3 months. Many are raising wages or plan to. Norfolk Southern is offering $600 million to resolve class action personal injury claims connected to the train derailment last year in East Palestine, Ohio, when toxic chemicals spilled and burned. The Environmental Protection Agency is tightening emissions requirements at chemical plants. It says this will affect more than 200 facilities located mostly in the country's center and south, such as Texas, Louisiana, and the Ohio River Valley. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the ninth day of April, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 7:13. It will set again at 9:09. That will give us 13 hours and 56 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 57 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high temperature for this date was 56 degrees. That was set in 1948. And a record low was 14 degrees, set in 1968. We were actually down to 17 degrees this morning. Currently, though, it's 27 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. They have variable winds at 6 miles per hour at the airport and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly cloudy skies for today and tonight. A 50% chance of snow showers today, high near 30, west winds to 10. Snow showers are quite likely tonight, mainly before 5 a.m., so most of the night. Mostly cloudy overnight, low of 27. Light north winds turning to the northeast to 10, could gust as high as 20 tonight. And they are talking about maybe an inch of snow falling overnight tonight. For tomorrow, chance of snow showers before 2 p.m., then a slight chance of snow showers after 5. Otherwise, partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 36, northwest winds to 15 or 20, gusting as high as 35, though. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will happen at 3:29 this afternoon and be 8.5 feet. That'll be followed by a low tide at 9:11 p.m. of 2/10. However, another significant low tide tomorrow morning, that's at 9:55 a.m., pretty good time to go tide pooling if you can. It's going to be minus 2.1 feet at 9:55 a.m. tomorrow morning here on the east side. Over on the west side, your upcoming high tide will happen at 3:57 this afternoon and be 15 feet in Larson Bay, followed by a low tide at 9:55 p.m. of 0 feet, and your significant low tide tomorrow will be a minus 3.5 foot minus tide at 10:30 a.m. in Larson Bay. Mariners, here is your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tomorrow. West winds to 30 knots, becoming northwest 25 tonight with 8-foot seas and freezing spray. For tomorrow, north 25 and seas to 6 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning for today. They are expecting northwest winds to 35 knots this afternoon, but seas are expected to build to 8 feet and then subside to 5 feet in the afternoon. Look for freezing spray in the Shelikof for today as well. For tomorrow, north 30 should come down to 20 knots after midnight and 5-foot seas. Freezing spray tomorrow in the Shelikof as well. Meetings are coming up in the Kodiak Island Borough, including tonight's meeting of the Service Area Number 1 Board. They will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And on Thursday, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All these meetings are open to the public, and the meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough's website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. Well, it's coming up. Mark your calendar on April 20th, the Diamond Jubilee edition of the Kodiak Arts Council's Art and Adventure Auction. It's happening at the Kodiak Marketplace this year on April 20th. Early bird tickets are available for $20, and tickets at the door are $25. Doors open at 6 p.m. with a full bar and silent auction, and at 7 p.m. the live auction begins. You can become a Diamond Jubilee table sponsor, too. You get 6 premium table tickets, 2 drink tickets per guest, and early access. For more information, call them at 907-942-5840.
Comfish Alaska takes place April 11th through 13th at the Kodiak Marketplace on Thursday and Friday from 10 to 4 and Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon. The forums will be held at the Best Western Kodiak Inn in the Harbor Room Thursday through Saturday. Learn the latest news and information in the industry during the forums and visit Alaska's largest commercial fishing trade show. Find out more at comfishak.com. Brought to you by the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce.